a mistake. There would have been no doubt about the justice of his case if he had sued, not for alteration costs, but for demolition costs. The attorney looked relieved.
"Will you explain your reasons, Miss Francon?"
"You have heard them from every witness at this trial."
"Then I take it that you agree with the preceding testimony?"
"Completely. Even more completely than the persons who testified. They were very convincing witnesses."
"Will you clarify that, Miss Francon? Just what do you mean?"
"What Mr. Toohey said. That this temple is a threat to all of us."
"Oh, I see."
Mr. Toohey understood the issue so well. "Shall I clarify it, in my own words?"
"By all means."
Howard Rourke built a temple to the human spirit. He saw man as strong, proud, clean, wise, and fearless. He saw man as a heroic being, and he built a temple to that. A temple is a place where man is to experience exaltation. He thought that exaltation comes from the consciousness of being guiltless, of seeing the truth and achieving it, of living up to one's highest possibility, of knowing no shame and having no cause for shame, of being able to stand naked in full sunlight. He thought that exaltation means joy, and that joy is man's birthright. He thought that a place built as a setting for man is a sacred place. That is what Howard Rourke thought of man and of exaltation. But Ellsworth Toohey said that this temple was a monument to a profound hatred of humanity. Ellsworth Toohey said that the essence of exaltation was to be scared out of your wits, to fall down and to grovel. Ellsworth Toohey said that man's highest act was to realize his own worthlessness and to beg forgiveness. Ellsworth Toohey said it was depraved not to take for granted that man is something which needs to be forgiven. Ellsworth Toohey saw that this building was of man and of the earth. And Ellsworth Toohey said that this building had its belly in the mud. To glorify man, said Ellsworth Toohey, was to glorify the gross pleasures of the flesh, for the realm of the spirit is beyond the grasp of man. To enter that realm, said Ellsworth Toohey, man must come as a beggar, on his knees. Ellsworth Toohey is a lover of mankind.
Miss Francon, we are not really discussing Mr. Toohey, so if you will confine yourself to—
I do not condemn Ellsworth Toohey. I condemn Howard Rourke. A building, they say, must be part of its site. In what kind of world did Rourke build his temple? For what kind of men? Look around you. Can you see a shrine becoming sacred by serving as a setting for Mr. Hopton Stoddard, for Mr. Ralston Holcomb, for Mr. Peter Keating? When you look at them all, do you hate Ellsworth Toohey? Or do you damn Howard Rourke for the unspeakable indignity which he did commit? Ellsworth Toohey is right. That temple is a sacrilege, though not in the sense he meant. I think Mr. Toohey knows that, however. When you see a man casting pearls without getting even a pork chop in return, it is not against the swine that you feel indignation. It is against the man who valued his pearls so little that he is willing to fling them into the muck and to let them become the occasion for a whole concert of grunting, transcribed by the court stenographer.
Miss Francon, I hardly think that this line of testimony is relevant or admissible. The witness must be allowed to testify, the judge declared unexpectedly.
He had been bored, and he liked to watch Dominique's figure. Besides, he knew that the audience was enjoying it, in the sheer excitement of scandal, even though their sympathies were with Hopton Stoddard.
Your Honor, some misunderstanding seems to have occurred, said the attorney. Miss Francon, for whom are you testifying? For Mr. Rourke or Mr. Stoddard?
For Mr. Stoddard, of course. I'm stating the reasons why Mr. Stoddard should win this case. I have sworn to tell the truth.
Proceed, said the judge.
All the witnesses have told the truth, but not the whole truth. I am merely filling in the omissions. They spoke of a threat and of hatred. They were right. The Stoddard Temple is a threat to many things. If it were allowed to exist, nobody would dare to look at himself in the mirror, and that is a cruel thing to do to men. Ask anything of men. Ask them to achieve wealth, fame, love, brutality, murder, self-sacrifice. But don't ask them to achieve self-respect. They will hate your soul. Well, they know best. They must have their reasons. They won't say, of course, that they hate you. They will say that you hate them. It's near enough, I suppose. They know the emotion involved. Such are men as they are. So what is the use of being a martyr to the impossible? What is the use of building for a world that does not exist?
Your Honor, I don't see what possible bearing this can have on... I am proving your case for you. I am proving why you must go with Ellsworth Toohey, as you will anyway. The Stoddard Temple must be destroyed, not to save men from it, but to save it from men. What's the difference, however? Mr. Stoddard wins. I'm in full agreement with everything that's being done here, except for one point. I didn't think we should be allowed to get away with that point. Let us destroy, but don't let us pretend that we are committing an act of virtue. Let us say that we are moles, and we object to mountain peaks. Or perhaps that we are lemmings, the animals who cannot help swimming out to self-destruction. I realize fully that at this moment I am as futile as Howard Rourke. This is my Stoddard Temple, my first and my last. She inclined her head to the judge. That is all, Your Honor. Your witness, the attorney snapped to Rourke. No questions, said Rourke. Dominique left the stand. The attorney bowed to the bench and said, The plaintiff rests. The judge turned to Rourke and made a vague gesture, inviting him to proceed. Rourke got up and walked to the bench, the brown envelope in hand. He took out of the envelope 10 photographs of the Stoddard Temple and laid them on the judge's desk. He said, The defense rests. Chapter 13 Hopton Stoddard won the suit. Ellsworth Toohey wrote in his column, Mr. Rourke pulled a Phryne in court and didn't get away with it. We never believed that story in the first place. Rourke was instructed to pay the costs of the temple's alterations. He said that he would not appeal the case. Hopton Stoddard announced that the temple would be remodeled into the Hopton Stoddard Home for Subnormal Children. On the day after the end of the trial, Alva Skerritt gasped when he glanced at the proofs of Your House delivered to his desk. The column contained most of Dominique's testimony in court. Her testimony had been quoted in the newspaper accounts of the case, but only in harmless excerpts. Alva Skerritt hurried to Dominique's office.
Darling, 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 he said.
We can't print that.
She looked at him blankly and said nothing.
Dominique, sweetheart, be reasonable. Quite apart from some of the language you use and some of your utterly unprintable ideas, you know very well the stand this paper has taken on the case. You know the campaign we've conducted. You've read my editorial this morning, A Victory for Decency. We can't have one writer running against our whole policy.
You'll have to print it.
But, sweetheart,
or I'll have to quit.
Oh, go on, go on, go on. Don't be silly. Now, don't get ridiculous. You know better than that. We can't get along without you. We can't...
You'll have to choose, Alva. Skerritt knew that he would get hell from Gail Winand if he printed the thing, and might get hell if he lost Dominique Francone, whose column was popular. Winand had not returned from his cruise. Skerritt cabled him in Bali, explaining the situation. Within a few hours, Skerritt received an answer. It was in Winand's private code. Translated, it read, Fire the bitch. G.W. Skerritt stared at the cable, crushed. It was an order that allowed no alternative, even if Dominique surrendered. He hoped she would resign. He could not face the thought of having to fire her. Through an office boy whom he had recommended for the job, Toohey obtained the decoded copy of Winand's cable. He put it in his pocket and went to Dominique's office. He had not seen her since the trial. He found her engaged in emptying the drawers of her desk.
Hello,
he said curtly.
What are you doing?
Waiting to hear from Alva Skerritt.
Meaning?
Waiting to hear whether I'll have to resign.
Feel like talking about the trial?
No.
I do. I think I owe you the courtesy of admitting that you've done what no one has ever done before. You proved me wrong.
He spoke coldly. His face looked flat. His eyes had no trace of kindness.
I had not expected you to do what you did on the stand. It was a scurvy trick, though up to your usual standard. I simply miscalculated the direction of your malice. However, you did have the good sense to admit that your act was futile. Of course, you made your point, and mine. As a token of appreciation, I have a present for you.
He laid the cable on her desk. She read it,
and stood holding it in her hand.
"You can't even resign, my dear," he said. "You can't make that sacrifice to your pearl-casting hero. Remembering that you attach such great importance to not being beaten except by your own hand, I thought you would enjoy this."
She folded the cable and slipped it into her purse. "Thank you, Ellsworth."
"If you're going to fight me, dear, it will take more than speeches."
"Haven't I always?"
"Yes, yes, of course you have, quite right. You're correcting me again. You have always fought me. And the only time you broke down and screamed for mercy was on that witness stand."
"That's right."
"That's where I miscalculated."
"Yes."
He bowed formally and left the room.
She made a package of the things she wanted to take home. Then she went to Skerritt's office. She showed him the cable in her hand, but she did not give it to him.
"Okay, Alva," she said. "Dominique, I couldn't help it. I couldn't help it. It was..."
"How the hell did you get that?"
"It's all right, Alva.
No, I won't give it back to you. I want to keep it."
She put the cable back in her bag.
"Mail me my check and anything else that has to be discussed."
You were going to resign anyway, weren't you?"
"Yes, I was. But I like it better, being fired."
"Dominique, if you knew how awful I feel about it. I can't believe it. I simply can't believe it."
"So you people made a martyr out of me after all. And that is the one thing I've tried all my life not to be. It's so graceless, being a martyr. It's honoring your adversaries too much. But I'll tell you this, Alva. I'll tell it to you because I couldn't find a less appropriate person to hear it. Nothing that you do to me, or to him, will be worse than what I'll do to myself. If you think I can't take the Stoddard Temple, wait till you see what I can take."
On an evening 3 days after the trial, Ellsworth Toohey sat in his room listening to the radio.
He did not feel like working, and he allowed himself a rest, relaxing luxuriously in an armchair, letting his fingers follow the rhythm of a complicated symphony.
He heard a knock at his door.
"Come in," he drawled.
Catherine came in. She glanced at the radio by way of apology for her entrance.
"I knew you weren't working, Uncle Ellsworth. I want to speak to you."
She stood slumped, her body thin and curveless. She wore a skirt of expensive tweed, unpressed. She had smeared some makeup on her face. The skin showed lifeless under the patches of powder. At 26, she looked like a woman trying to hide the fact of being over 30. In the last few years, with her uncle's help, she had become an able social worker. She held a paid job in a settlement house. She had a small bank account of her own. She took her friends out to lunch, older women of her profession, and they talked about the problems of unwed mothers, self-expression for the children of the poor, and the evils of industrial corporations. But in the last few years, Toohey seemed to have forgotten her existence. But he knew that she was enormously aware of him, in her silent, self-effacing way. He was seldom first to speak to her. But she came to him continuously for minor advice. She was like a small motor running on his energy, and she had to stop for refueling once in a while. She would not go to the theater without consulting him about the play. She would not attend a lecture course without asking his opinion. Once she developed a friendship with a girl who was intelligent, capable, gay, and loved the poor, though a social worker. Toohey did not approve of the girl. Catherine dropped her. When she needed advice, she asked for it briefly, in passing, anxious not to delay him, between the courses of a meal, at the elevator door on his way out, in the living room when some important broadcast stopped for station identification. She made it a point to show that she would presume to claim nothing but the waste scraps of his time. So Toohey looked at her surprised when she entered his study. He said,
"Certainly, pet. I'm not busy. I'm never too busy for you anyway. Turn the thing down a bit, will you?"
She softened the volume of the radio, and she slumped down in an armchair facing him. Her movements were awkward and contradictory, like an adolescent's. She had lost the habit of moving with assurance, and yet at times a gesture, a jerk of her head, would show a dry, overbearing impatience which she was beginning to develop.
She looked at her uncle. Behind her glasses, her eyes were still and tense, but unrevealing. She said, "What have you been doing, Uncle Ellsworth? I saw something in the papers about winning some big lawsuit that you were connected with. I was glad. I haven't read the papers for months. I've been so busy." "No, that's not quite true. I've had the time, but when I came home, I just couldn't make myself do anything. I just fell in bed and went to sleep." "Uncle Ellsworth, do people sleep a lot because they're tired, or because they want to escape from something?"
"Now, my dear, this doesn't sound like you at all. None of it."
She shook her head helplessly.
"I know."
"What is the matter?"
She said, looking at the toes of her shoes, her lips moving with effort.
"I guess I'm no good, Uncle Ellsworth."
She raised her eyes to him.
"I'm so terribly unhappy."
He looked at her silently, his face earnest, his eyes gentle. She whispered,
"You understand?"
He nodded.
"You're not angry at me? You don't despise me?"
"My dear, how could I?"
"I didn't want to say it. Not even to myself. It's not just tonight. It's for a long time back. Just let me say everything. Don't be shocked. I've got to tell it. It's like going to confession, as I used to. Oh, don't think I'm returning to that. I know religion is only a device of class exploitation. Don't think I'd let you down after you explained it all so well. I don't miss going to church. But it's just that I've got to have somebody listen."
"Katie, darling, first of all, why are you so frightened? You mustn't be. Certainly not of speaking to me. Just relax, be yourself, and tell me what happened."
She looked at him gratefully.
"You're so sensitive, Uncle Ellsworth. That's one thing I didn't want to say, but you guessed. I am frightened, because, well, you see, you just said be yourself, and what I'm afraid of most is of being myself, because I'm vicious."
He laughed, not offensively, but warmly, the sound destroying her statement. But she did not smile.
"No, Uncle Ellsworth, it's true. I'll try to explain. You see, always, since I was a child, I wanted to do right. I used to think everybody did, but now I don't think so. Some people try their best, even if they do make mistakes, and others just don't care. I've always cared. I took it very seriously. Of course, I knew that I'm not a brilliant person, and that it's a very big subject, good and evil, but I felt that whatever is the good, as much as it would be possible for me to know, I would do my honest best to live up to it, which is all anybody can try, isn't it? This probably sounds terribly childish to you."
"No, Katie, it doesn't. Go on, my dear."
"Well, to begin with, I knew that it was evil to be selfish. That much I was sure of, so I tried never to demand anything for myself. When Peter would disappear for months..." "No, I don't think you approve of that."
"Of what, my dear?"
"Of Peter and me. So I won't talk about that. It's not important, anyway. Well, you can see why I was so happy when I came to live with you. You're as close to the ideal of unselfishness as anyone can be. I tried to follow you the best I could. That's how I chose the work I'm doing. You never actually said that I should choose it, but I came to feel that you thought so. Don't ask me how I came to feel it. It was nothing tangible. Just little things you said. I felt very confident when I started. I knew that unhappiness comes from selfishness, and that one can find true happiness only in dedicating oneself to others. You said that. So many people have said that. Why, all the greatest men in history have been saying that for centuries."
"And?"
"Well, look at me."
His face remained motionless for a moment. Then he smiled gaily and said,
"What's wrong with you, pet? Apart from the fact that your stockings don't match, and that you could be more careful about your makeup."
"Don't laugh, Uncle Ellsworth, please, don't laugh. I know you say we must be able to laugh at everything, particularly at ourselves, only I can't."
"I won't laugh, Katie. But what is the matter?"
"I'm unhappy. I'm unhappy in such a horrible, nasty, undignified way, in a way that seems unclean and dishonest. I go for days afraid to think, to look at myself, and that's wrong. It's becoming a hypocrite. I always wanted to be honest with myself, but I'm not. I'm not. I'm not.
Hold on, my dear. Don't shout. The neighbors will hear you.
She brushed the back of her hand against her forehead. She shook her head. She whispered, I'm sorry. I'll be all right.
Just why are you unhappy, my dear?
I don't know. I can't understand it. For instance, it was I who arranged to have the classes in prenatal care down at the Clifford House. It was my idea. I raised the money. I found the teacher. The classes are doing very well. I tell myself that I should be happy about it. But I'm not. It doesn't seem to make any difference to me. I sit down and I tell myself, it was you who arranged to have Marie Gonzalez's baby adopted into a nice family. Now be happy. But I'm not. I feel nothing. When I'm honest with myself, I know that the only emotion I've felt for years is being tired. Not physically tired, just tired. It's as if there were nobody there to feel anymore. She took off her glasses, as if the double barrier of her glasses and his prevented her from reaching him. She spoke, her voice lower, the words coming with greater effort. But that's not all. There's something much worse. It's doing something horrible to me. I'm beginning to hate people, Uncle Ellsworth. I'm beginning to be cruel and mean and petty in a way I've never been before. I expect people to be grateful to me. I demand gratitude. I find myself pleased when slum people bow and scrape and fawn over me. I find myself liking only those who are servile. Once I told a woman that she didn't appreciate what people like us did for trash like her. I cried for hours afterward. I was so ashamed. I begin to resent it when people argue with me. I feel that they have no right to minds of their own, that I know best, that I'm the final authority for them. There was a girl we were worried about, because she was running around with a very handsome boy who had a bad reputation. I tortured her for weeks about it, telling her how he'd get her in trouble and that she should drop him. Well, they got married, and they're the happiest couple in the district. Do you think I'm glad? No, I'm furious, and I'm barely civil to the girl when I meet her. Then there was a girl who needed a job desperately. It was really a ghastly situation in her home, and I promised that I'd get her one. Before I could find it, she got a good job all by herself. I wasn't pleased. I was sore as hell that somebody got out of a bad hole without my help. Yesterday I was speaking to a boy who wanted to go to college, and I was discouraging him, telling him to get a good job instead. I was quite angry, too. And suddenly I realized that it was because I had wanted so much to go to college. You remember, you wouldn't let me. And so I wasn't going to let that kid do it either. Uncle Ellsworth, don't you see? I'm becoming selfish. I'm becoming selfish in a way that's much more horrible than if I were some petty chiseler pinching pennies off these people's wages in a sweatshop. He asked quietly,
Is that all?
She closed her eyes, and then she said, looking down at her hands, Yes, except that I'm not the only one who's like that. A lot of them are. Most of the women I work with. I don't know how they got that way. I don't know how it happened to me. I used to feel happy when I helped somebody. I remember once. I had lunch with Peter that day, and on my way back I saw an old organ grinder, and I gave him $5 I had in my bag. It was all the money I had. I'd saved it to buy a bottle of Christmas Night. I wanted Christmas Night very badly. But afterward, every time I thought of that organ grinder, I was happy. I saw Peter often in those days. I'd come home after seeing him, and I'd want to kiss every ragged kid on our block. I think I hate the poor now. I think all the other women do, too. But the poor don't hate us, as they should. They only despise us. You know, it's funny. It's the masters who despise the slaves, and the slaves who hate the masters. I don't know who is which. Maybe it doesn't fit here. Maybe it does. I don't know.
She raised her head with a last spurt of rebellion.
Don't you see what it is that I must understand? Why is it that I set out honestly to do what I thought was right, and it's making me rotten? I think it's probably because I'm vicious by nature and incapable of leading a good life. That seems to be the only explanation. But sometimes I think it doesn't make sense that a human being is completely sincere in goodwill, and yet the good is not for him to achieve. I can't be as rotten as that. But I've given up everything. I have no selfish desire left. I have nothing of my own. And I'm miserable. And so are the other women like me. And I don't know a single selfless person in the world who's happy. Except you.
She dropped her head, and she did not raise it again. She seemed indifferent, even to the answer she was seeking.
"Katie," he said softly, reproachfully. "Katie, darling."
She waited silently.
"Do you really want me to tell you the answer?"
She nodded.
"Because you know you've given the answer yourself in the things you said."
She lifted her eyes blankly.
"What have you been talking about? What have you been complaining about? About the fact that you are unhappy, about Katie Halsey and nothing else. It was the most egotistical speech I've ever heard in my life."
She blinked attentively, like a schoolchild disturbed by a difficult lesson.
"Don't you see how selfish you have been? You chose a noble career, not for the good you could accomplish, but for the personal happiness you expected to find in it."
"But I really wanted to help people."
"Because you thought you'd be good and virtuous doing it."
"Why, yes, because I thought it was right."
"Is it vicious to want to do right?"
"Yes, if it's your chief concern. Don't you see how egotistical it is? To hell with everybody so long as I'm virtuous."
"But if you have no self-respect, how can you be anything?"
"Why must you be anything?"
She spread her hands out, bewildered.
"If your first concern is for what you are or think or feel or haven't got, you're still a common egotist."
"But I can't jump out of my own body."
"No, but you can jump out of your narrow soul."
"You mean I must want to be unhappy?"
"No, you must stop wanting anything. You must forget how important Miss Catherine Halsey is. Because, you see, she isn't. Men are important only in relation to other men, in their usefulness, in the service they render. Unless you understand that completely, you can expect nothing but one form of misery or another. Why make such a cosmic tragedy out of the fact that you found yourself feeling cruel toward people? So what? It's just growing pains. One can't jump from a state of animal brutality into a state of spiritual living without certain transitions, and some of them may seem evil. A beautiful woman is usually a gawky adolescent first. All growth demands destruction. You can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. You must be willing to suffer, to be cruel, to be dishonest, to be unclean. Anything, my dear, anything to kill the most stubborn of roots, the ego. And only when it is dead, when you care no longer, when you have lost your identity and forgotten the name of your soul, only then will you know the kind of happiness I spoke about, and the gates of spiritual grandeur will fall open before you."
"But, Uncle Ellsworth," she whispered, "when the gates fall open, who is it that's going to enter?"
He laughed aloud, crisply. It sounded like a laugh of appreciation.
"My dear," he said, "I never thought you could surprise me."
Then his face became earnest again.
"It was a smart crack, Katie. But you know, I hope, that it was only a smart crack."
"Yes," she said uncertainly. "I suppose so. Still..."
"We can't be too literal when we deal in abstractions. Of course it's you who'll enter. You won't have lost your identity. You will merely have acquired a broader one, an identity that will be part of everybody else and of the whole universe."
"How? In what way? Part of what?"
"Now you see how difficult it is to discuss these things when our entire language is the language of individualism, with all its terms and superstitions. Identity. It's an illusion, you know. But you can't build a new house out of crumbling old bricks. You can't expect to understand me completely through the medium of present-day conceptions. We are poisoned by the superstition of the ego.
We cannot know what will be right or wrong in a selfless society, nor what we'll feel, nor in what manner. We must destroy the ego first. That is why the mind is so unreliable. We must not think. We must believe. Believe, Katie, even if your mind objects. Don't think, believe. Trust your heart, not your brain. Don't think. Feel. Believe. She sat still, composed. But somehow she looked like something run over by a tank. She whispered obediently, "Yes, Uncle Ellsworth, I didn't think of it that way. I mean, I always thought that I must think. But you're right, that is, if right is the word I mean, if there is a word. Yes, I will believe. I'll try to understand. No, not to understand, to feel, to believe. I mean, only I'm so weak. I always feel so small after talking to you. I suppose I was right in a way. I am worthless. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter." When the doorbell rang on the following evening, Toohey went to open the door himself. He smiled when he admitted Peter Keating. After the trial, he had expected Keating to come to him. He knew that Keating would need to come, but he had expected him sooner. Keating walked in uncertainly. His hands seemed too heavy for his wrists. His eyes were puffed, and the skin of his face looked slack.
"Hello, Peter," said Toohey brightly. "Want to see me? Come right in. Just your luck, I have the whole evening free."
"No," said Keating. "I want to see Katie." He was not looking at Toohey, and he did not see the expression behind Toohey's glasses.
"Katie? But of course," said Toohey gaily. "You know you've never come here to call on Katie, so it didn't occur to me, but go right in. I believe she's home. This way. You don't know her room? Second door."
Keating shuffled heavily down the hall, knocked on Catherine's door, and went in when she answered. Toohey stood looking after him, his face thoughtful. Catherine jumped to her feet when she saw her guest. She stood stupidly, incredulously for a moment. Then she dashed to her bed to snatch a girdle she had left lying there and stuff it hurriedly under the pillow. Then she jerked off her glasses, closed her whole fist over them, and slipped them into her pocket. She wondered which would be worse, to remain as she was, or to sit down at her dressing table and make up her face in his presence. She had not seen Keating for 6 months. In the last 3 years they had met occasionally, at long intervals. They had had a few luncheons together, a few dinners. They had gone to the movies twice. They had always met in a public place. Since the beginning of his acquaintance with Toohey, Keating would not come to see her at her home. When they met, they talked as if nothing had changed. But they had not spoken of marriage for a long time. "Hello, Katie," said Keating softly. "I didn't know you wore glasses now. It's only for reading. Hello, Peter. I guess I look terrible tonight. I'm glad to see you, Peter." He sat down heavily, his hat in his hand, his overcoat on. She stood smiling helplessly. Then she made a vague circular motion with her hands and asked, "Is it just for a little while, or do you want to take your coat off?" "No, it's not just for a little while." He got up, threw his coat and hat on the bed. Then he smiled for the first time and asked, "Or are you busy and want to throw me out?" She pressed the heels of her hands against her eye sockets and dropped her hands again quickly. She had to meet him as she had always met him. She had to sound light and normal. "No, no, I'm not busy at all." He sat down and stretched out his arm in silent invitation. She came to him promptly. She put her hand in his, and he pulled her down to the arm of his chair. The lamplight fell on him, and she had recovered enough to notice the appearance of his face.
"Peter," she gasped, "what have you been doing to yourself? You look awful."
"Drinking."
"Not like that."
"Like that. But it's over now."
"What was it?"
"I wanted to see you, Katie. I wanted to see you."
"Darling, what have they done to you?"
"Nobody's done anything to me. I'm all right now. I'm all right. Because I came here." Katie, have you ever heard of Hopton Stoddard?
Stoddard?
I don't know. I've seen the name somewhere.
Well, never mind. It doesn't matter.
I was only thinking how strange it is. You see, Stoddard's an old bastard who just couldn't take his own rottenness anymore, so to make up for it, he built a big present to the city. But when I couldn't take it anymore, I felt that the only way I could make up for it was by doing the thing I really wanted to do most. By coming here.
When you couldn't take? What, Peter?
I've done something very dirty, Katie. I'll tell you about it someday, but not now. Look, will you say that you forgive me, without asking what it is? I'll think that I've been forgiven by someone who can never forgive me. Someone who can't be hurt, and so can't forgive. But that makes it worse for me.
She did not seem perplexed. She said earnestly,
I forgive you, Peter.
He nodded his head slowly several times and said,
Thank you.
Then she pressed her head to his, and she whispered,
You've gone through hell, haven't you?
Yes. But it's all right now. He pulled her into his arms and kissed her. Then he did not think of the Stoddard Temple any longer, and she did not think of good and evil. They did not need to. They felt too clean.
Katie, why haven't we married?
I don't know, she said. And added hastily, saying it only because her heart was pounding, because she could not remain silent, and because she felt called upon not to take advantage of him.
I guess it's because we know we don't have to hurry.
But we do. If we're not too late already.
Peter, you're not proposing to me again.
Don't look so stunned, Katie. If you do, I'll know that you've doubted it all these years, and I couldn't stand to think that just now. That's what I came here to tell you tonight. We're going to get married. We're going to get married right away.
Yes, Peter.
We don't need announcements, dates, preparations, guests, any of it. We've let one of those things or another stop us every time. I honestly don't know just how it happened, that we've let it all drift like that. We won't say anything to anyone. We'll just slip out of town and get married. We'll announce and explain afterward if anyone wants explanations, and that means your uncle and my mother and everybody.
Yes, Peter.
Quit your damn job tomorrow. I'll make arrangements at the office to take a month off. Guy will be sore as hell. I'll enjoy that. Get your things ready. You won't need much. Don't bother about the makeup, by the way. Did you say you looked terrible tonight? You've never looked lovelier. And I'll be here at 9 o'clock in the morning, day after tomorrow. You must be ready to start then.
Yes, Peter.
After he had gone, she lay on her bed sobbing aloud, without restraint, without dignity, without a care in the world. Ellsworth Toohey had left the door of his study open. He had seen Keating pass by the door without noticing it and go out. Then he heard the sound of Catherine's sobs. He walked to her room and entered without knocking. He asked,
What's the matter, my dear? Has Peter done something to hurt you?
She half lifted herself on the bed. She looked at him, throwing her hair back off her face, sobbing exultantly. She said without thinking the first thing she felt like saying. She said something which she did not understand. But he did.
I'm not afraid of you, Uncle Ellsworth.
Chapter 14
Who? Gasped Keating.
Miss Dominique Francon, the maid repeated.
You're drunk, you damn fool. Mr. Keating!
He was on his feet. He shoved her out of the way. He flew into the living room and saw Dominique Francon standing there in his apartment.
Hello, Peter.
Dominique. Dominique, how come?
In his anger, apprehension, curiosity, and flattered pleasure, his first conscious thought was gratitude to God that his mother was not at home.
I phoned your office. They said you had gone home.
I'm so delighted. So pleasantly sur- Oh, hell, Dominique, what's the use? I always try to be correct with you, and you always see through it so well that it's perfectly pointless. So I won't play the poised host. You know that I'm knocked silly, and that your coming here isn't natural, and anything I say will probably be wrong.
Yes, that's better, Peter.
He noticed that he still held a key in his hand, and he slipped it into his pocket.
He had been packing a suitcase for his wedding trip of tomorrow. He glanced at the room and noted angrily how vulgar his Victorian furniture looked beside the elegance of Dominique's figure. She wore a gray suit, a black fur jacket with a collar raised to her cheeks, and a hat slanting down. She did not look as she had looked on the witness stand, nor as he remembered her at dinner parties. He thought suddenly of that moment years ago, when he stood on the stair landing outside Guy Francon's office, and wished never to see Dominique again. She was what she had been then, a stranger who frightened him by the crystal emptiness of her face. "Well, sit down, Dominique. Take your coat off. No, I shan't stay long. Since we're not pretending anything today, shall I tell you what I came for? Or do you want some polite conversation first?" "No, I don't want polite conversation." "All right. Will you marry me, Peter?" He stood very still. Then he sat down heavily, because he knew she meant it. "If you want to marry me," she went on in the same precise, impersonal voice, "you must do it right now. My car is downstairs. We drive to Connecticut, and we come back. It will take about 3 hours." "Dominique." He didn't want to move his lips beyond the effort of her name. He wanted to think that he was paralyzed. He knew that he was violently alive, that he was forcing the stupor into his muscles and into his mind, because he wished to escape the responsibility of consciousness. "We're not pretending, Peter. Usually people discuss their reasons and their feelings first, then make the practical arrangements. With us, this is the only way. If I offered it to you in any other form, I'd be cheating you. It must be like this. No questions, no conditions, no explanations. What we don't say answers itself by not being said. There is nothing for you to ponder, only whether you want to do it or not." "Dominique." He spoke with the concentration he used when he walked down a naked girder in an unfinished building. "I understand only this much. I understand that I must try to imitate you, not to discuss it, not to talk. Just answer."
"Yes."
"Only, I can't, quite." "This is one time, Peter, when there are no protections, nothing to hide behind, not even words. If you'd just say one thing,
no.
If you'd give me time, no. Either we go downstairs together now, or we forget it. You mustn't resent it if I... You've never allowed me to hope that you could... that you... No. No, I won't say it. But what can you expect me to think? I'm here, alone, and I'm the only one present to give you advice. My advice is to refuse. I'm honest with you, Peter, but I won't help you by withdrawing the offer. You would prefer not to have had the chance of marrying me, but you have the chance. Now, the choice will be yours." Then he could not hold on to his dignity any longer. He let his head drop. He pressed his fist to his forehead.
"Dominique, why?"
"You know the reasons. I told them to you once long ago. If you haven't the courage to think of them, don't expect me to repeat them." He sat still, his head down. Then he said,
"Dominique, two people like you and me getting married, it's almost a front-page event."
"Yes." "Wouldn't it be better to do it properly, with an announcement and a real wedding ceremony?" "I'm strong, Peter, but I'm not that strong. You can have your receptions and your publicity afterward."
"You don't want me to say anything now, except yes or no?
That's all." He sat looking up at her for a long time. Her glance was on his eyes, but it had no more reality than the glance of a portrait. He felt alone in the room. She stood patient, waiting, granting him nothing, not even the kindness of prompting him to hurry.
"All right, Dominique."
"Yes," he said at last. She inclined her head gravely in acquiescence. He stood up.
"I'll get my coat," he said. "Do you want to take your car?"
"Yes."
"It's an open car, isn't it? Should I wear my fur coat?"
"No, take a warm muffler, though. There's a little wind."
"No luggage? We're coming right back to the city?"
We're coming right back.
He left the door to the hall open, and she saw him putting on his coat, throwing a muffler around his throat, with the gesture of flinging a cape over his shoulder. He stepped to the door of the living room, hat in hand, and invited her to go, with a silent movement of his head. In the hall outside, he pressed the button of the elevator, and he stepped back to let her enter first. He was precise, sure of himself, without joy, without emotion. He seemed more coldly masculine than he had ever been before. He took her elbow firmly, protectively, to cross the street where she had left her car. He opened the car's door, let her slide behind the wheel, and got in silently beside her. She leaned over across him and adjusted the glass windscreen on his side. She said, "If it's not right, fix it any way you want when we start moving, so it won't be too cold for you." He said, "Get to the Grand Concourse. Fewer lights there." She put her handbag down on his lap while she took the wheel and started the car. There was suddenly no antagonism between them, but a quiet, hopeless feeling of comradeship, as if they were victims of the same impersonal disaster who had to help each other. She drove fast, as a matter of habit, an even speed, without a sense of haste. They sat silently to the level drone of the motor, and they sat patiently, without shifting the positions of their bodies, when the car stopped for a light. They seemed caught in a single streak of motion, an imperative direction like the flight of a bullet that could not be stopped on its course. There was a first hint of twilight in the streets of the city. The pavements looked yellow. The shops were still open. A movie theater had lighted its sign, and the red bulbs whirled jerkily, sucking the last daylight out of the air, making the street look darker. Peter Keating felt no need of speech. He did not seem to be Peter Keating any longer. He did not ask for warmth, and he did not ask for pity. He asked nothing. She thought of that once, and she glanced at him, a glance of appreciation that was almost gentle. He met her eyes steadily. She saw understanding, but no comment. It was as if his glance said, "Of course," nothing else. They were out of the city, with a cold brown road flying to meet them, when he said, "The traffic cops are bad around here. Got your press card with you, just in case?" "I'm not the press any longer."
"You're not what?"
"I'm not a newspaper woman anymore."
"You quit your job?"
"No, I was fired."
"What are you talking about?"
"Where have you been the last few days? I thought everybody knew it."
"Sorry. I didn't follow things very well the last few days."
Miles later, she said, "Give me a cigarette, in my bag." He opened her bag, and he saw her cigarette case, her compact, her lipstick, her comb, a folded handkerchief, too white to touch, smelling faintly of her perfume. Somewhere within him he thought that this was almost like unbuttoning her blouse. But most of him was not conscious of the thought, nor of the intimate proprietorship with which he opened the bag. He took a cigarette from her case, lighted it, and put it from his lips to hers.
"Thanks," she said.
He lighted one for himself and closed the bag. When they reached Greenwich, it was he who made the inquiries, told her where to drive, at what block to turn, and said, "Here it is," when they pulled up in front of the judge's house. He got out first and helped her out of the car. He pressed the button of the doorbell. They were married in a living room that displayed armchairs of faded tapestry, blue and purple, and a lamp with a fringe of glass beads. The witnesses were the judge's wife and someone from next door named Chuck, who had been interrupted at some household task and smelled faintly of Clorox. Then they came back to their car, and Keating asked, "Want me to drive if you're tired?" She said, "No, I'll drive." The road to the city cut through brown fields, where every rise in the ground had a shade of tired red on the side facing west. There was a purple haze eating away the edges of the fields, and a motionless streak of fire in the sky. A few cars came toward them as brown shapes, still visible. Others had their lights on, two disquieting spots of yellow. Keating watched the road. It looked narrow, a small dash in the middle of the windshield, framed by earth and hills, all of it held within the rectangle of glass before him. But the road spread as the windshield flew forward,
The road filled the glass. It ran over the edges. It tore apart to let them pass, streaming in two gray bands on either side of the car. He thought it was a race, and he waited to see the windshield win, to see the car hurtle into that small dash before it had time to stretch.
"Where are we going to live now, at first?" he asked.
"Your place or mine?"
"Yours, of course."
"I'd rather move to yours."
"No. I'm closing my place."
"You can't possibly like my apartment."
"Why not?"
"I don't know. It doesn't fit you."
"I like it."
They were silent for a while. Then he asked, "How are we going to announce this now?"
"In any way you wish. I'll leave it up to you."
It was growing darker, and she switched on the car's headlights. He watched the small blurs of traffic signs, low by the side of the road, springing suddenly into life as they approached, spelling out left turn, crossing ahead, in dots of light that seemed conscious, malevolent, winking. They drove silently. But there was no bond in their silence now. They were not walking together toward disaster. The disaster had come. Their courage did not matter any longer. He felt disturbed and uncertain, as he always felt in the presence of Dominique Francon. He half turned to look at her. She kept her eyes on the road. Her profile in the cold wind was serene and remote and lovely in a way that was hard to bear. He looked at her gloved hands resting firmly, one on each side of the wheel. He looked down at her slender foot on the accelerator. Then his eyes rose up the line of her leg. His glance remained on the narrow triangle of her tight gray skirt. He realized suddenly that he had a right to think what he was thinking. For the first time, this implication of marriage occurred to him fully and consciously. Then he knew that he had always wanted this woman, that it was the kind of feeling he would have for a whore, only lasting and hopeless and vicious. "My wife," he thought for the first time, without a trace of respect in the word. He felt so violent a desire that had it been summer, he would have ordered her to drive into the first side lane, and he would have taken her there. He slipped his arm along the back of the seat and encircled her shoulders, his fingers barely touching her. She did not move, resist, or turn to look at him. He pulled his arm away, and he sat staring straight ahead. "Mrs. Keating," he said flatly, not addressing her, just as a statement of fact.
"Mrs. Peter Keating," she said.
When they stopped in front of his apartment house, he got out and held the door for her, but she remained sitting behind the wheel.
"Good night, Peter," she said.
"I'll see you tomorrow." She added, before the expression of his face had turned into an obscene swear word, "I'll send my things over tomorrow and we'll discuss everything then. Everything will begin tomorrow, Peter."
"Where are you going?"
"I have things to settle."
"But what will I tell people tonight?"
"Anything you wish, if at all." She swung the car into the traffic and drove away. When she entered Rourke's room that evening, he smiled. Not his usual faint smile of acknowledging the expected, but a smile that spoke of waiting and pain. He had not seen her since the trial. She had left the courtroom after her testimony, and he had heard nothing from her since. He had come to her house, but her maid had told him that Miss Francon could not see him. She looked at him now, and she smiled. It was for the first time like a gesture of complete acceptance, as if the sight of him solved everything, answered all questions, and her meaning was only to be a woman who looked at him. They stood silently before each other for a moment, and she thought that the most beautiful words were those which were not needed. When he moved, she said, "Don't say anything about the trial. Afterward." When he took her in his arms, she turned her body to meet his straight on, to feel the width of his chest with the width of hers, the length of his legs with the length of hers, as if she were lying against him, and her feet felt no weight, and she was held upright by the pressure of his body. They lay in bed together that night, and they did not know when they slept, the intervals of exhausted unconsciousness as intense an act of union as the convulsed meetings of their bodies.
In the morning, when they were dressed, she watched him move about the room. She saw the drained relaxation of his movements. She thought of what she had taken from him, and the heaviness of her wrists told her that her own strength was now in his nerves, as if they had exchanged their energy. He was at the other end of the room, his back turned to her for a moment, when she said, "Rourke," her voice quiet and low. He turned to her, as if he had expected it, and perhaps guessed the rest. She stood in the middle of the floor, as she had stood on her first night in this room, solemnly composed to the performance of a rite. "I love you, Rourke." She had said it for the first time. She saw the reflection of her next words on his face before she had pronounced them. "I was married yesterday to Peter Keating." It would have been easy if she had seen a man distorting his mouth to bite off sound, closing his fists and twisting them in defense against himself. But it was not easy, because she did not see him doing this, yet knew that this was being done without the relief of a physical gesture. "Rourke," she whispered, gently, frightened. He said, "I'm all right." Then he said, "Please wait a moment." "All right. Go on." "Rourke, before I met you, I'd always been afraid of seeing someone like you because I knew that I'd also have to see what I saw in the witness stand, and I'd have to do what I did in that courtroom. I hated doing it, because it was an insult to you to defend you, and it was an insult to myself that you had to be defended. Rourke, I can accept anything except what seems to be the easiest for most people. The halfway, the almost, the just about, the in-between. They may have their justifications. I don't know. I don't care to inquire. I know that it is the one thing not given me to understand. When I think of what you are, I can't accept any reality except a world of your kind, or at least a world in which you have a fighting chance and a fight on your own terms. That does not exist, and I can't live a life torn between that which exists and you. It would mean to struggle against things and men who don't deserve to be your opponents. Your fight, using their methods, and that's too horrible a desecration. It would mean doing for you what I did for Peter Keating. Lie, flatter, evade, compromise, pander to every ineptitude, in order to beg of them a chance for you, beg them to let you live, to let you function. To beg them, Rourke, not to laugh at them, but to tremble because they hold the power to hurt you. Am I too weak because I can't do this? I don't know which is the greater strength, to accept all this for you, or to love you so much that the rest is beyond acceptance. I don't know. I love you too much." He looked at her, waiting. She knew that he had understood this long ago, but that it had to be said. "You're not aware of them. I am. I can't help it. I love you. The contrast is too great. Rourke, you won't win. They'll destroy you. But I won't be there to see it happen. I will have destroyed myself first. That's the only gesture of protest open to me. What else could I offer you? The things people sacrifice are so little. I'll give you my marriage to Peter Keating. I'll refuse to permit myself happiness in their world. I'll take suffering. That will be my answer to them, and my gift to you. I shall probably never see you again. I shall try not to. But I will live for you through every minute and every shameful act I take. I will live for you in my own way, in the only way I can." He made a movement to speak, and she said, "Wait, let me finish. You could ask, why not kill myself then?" "Because I love you, because you exist. That alone is so much that it won't allow me to die. And since I must be alive in order to know that you are, I will live in the world as it is, in the manner of life it demands. Not halfway, but completely. Not pleading and running from it, but walking out to meet it, beating it to the pain and the ugliness, being first to choose the worst it can do to me, not as the wife of some half-decent human being, but as the wife of Peter Keating. And only within my own mind, only where nothing can touch it, kept sacred by the protecting wall of my own degradation, there will be the thought of you and the knowledge of you, and I shall say, 'Howard Rourke,' to myself once in a while. And I shall feel that I have deserved to say it." She stood before him, her face raised, Her lips were not drawn, but closed softly. Yet the shape of her mouth was too definite on her face, a shape of pain and tenderness, and resignation. In his face, she saw suffering that was made old, as if it had been part of him for a long time, because it was accepted. And it looked not like a wound, but like a scar.
Dominique, if I told you now to have that marriage annulled at once, to forget the world and my struggle, to feel no anger, no concern, no hope, just to exist for me, for my need of you as my wife, as my property.
He saw in her face what she had seen in his when she told him of her marriage, but he was not frightened, and he watched it calmly. After a while she answered, and the words did not come from her lips, but as if her lips were forced to gather the sounds from the outside.
I'd obey you.
Now you see why I won't do it. I won't try to stop you. I love you, Dominique.
She closed her eyes, and he said, You'd rather not hear it now, but I want you to hear it. We never need to say anything to each other when we're together. This is for the time when we won't be together. I love you, Dominique, as selfishly as the fact that I exist, as selfishly as my lungs breathe air. I breathe for my own necessity, for the fuel of my body, for my survival. I've given you not my sacrifice or my pity, but my ego and my naked need. This is the only way you can wish to be loved. This is the only way I can want you to love me. If you married me now, I would become your whole existence. But I would not want you then. You would not want yourself, and so you would not love me long. To say, I love you, one must know first how to say the I. The kind of surrender I could have from you now would give me nothing but an empty hulk. If I demanded it, I'd destroy you. That's why I won't stop you. I'll let you go to your husband. I don't know how I'll live through tonight, but I will. I want you whole, as I am, as you'll remain in the battle you've chosen. A battle is never selfless. She heard in the measured tension of his words that it was harder for him to speak them than for her to listen. So she listened.
You must learn not to be afraid of the world, not to be held by it as you are now, never to be hurt by it as you were in that courtroom. I must let you learn it. I can't help you. You must find your own way. When you have, you'll come back to me. They won't destroy me, Dominique. And they won't destroy you. You'll win, because you've chosen the hardest way of fighting for your freedom from the world. I'll wait for you. I love you. I'm saying this now for all the years we'll have to wait. I love you, Dominique.
Then he kissed her, and he let her go. Chapter 15. At 9 o'clock that morning, Peter Keating was pacing the floor of his room, his door locked. He forgot that it was 9 o'clock and that Catherine was waiting for him. He had made himself forget her and everything she implied. The door of his room was locked to protect him from his mother. Last night, seeing his furious restlessness, she had forced him to tell her the truth. He had snapped that he was married to Dominique Francon, and he had added some sort of explanation about Dominique going out of town to announce the marriage to some old relative. His mother had been so busy with gasps of delight and questions that he had been able to answer nothing and to hide his panic. He was not certain that he had a wife and that she would come back to him in the morning. He had forbidden his mother to announce the news, but she had made a few telephone calls last night, and she was making a few more this morning, and now their telephone was ringing constantly, with eager voices asking, "Is it true?" pouring out sounds of amazement and congratulations. Keating could see the news spreading through the city in widening circles by the names and social positions of the people who called. He refused to answer the telephone. It seemed to him that every corner of New York was flooded with celebration, and that he alone, hidden in the watertight caisson of his room, was cold and lost and horrified. It was almost noon when the doorbell rang, and he pressed his hands to his ears, not to know who it was and what they wanted. Then he heard his mother's voice, so shrill with joy that it sounded embarrassingly silly.
"Petey, darling, don't you want to come out and kiss your wife?"
He flew out into the hall, And there was Dominique, removing her soft mink coat, the fur throwing to his nostrils a wave of the street's cold air, touched by her perfume. She was smiling correctly, looking straight at him, saying, "Good morning, Peter." He stood drawn up for one instant, and in that instant he relived all the telephone calls and felt the triumph to which they entitled him. He moved as a man in the arena of a crowded stadium. He smiled as if he felt the ray of an arc light playing in the creases of his smile, and he said, "Dominique, my dear, this is like a dream come true." The dignity of their doomed understanding was gone, and their marriage was what it had been intended to be. She seemed glad of it. She said, "Sorry you didn't carry me over the threshold, Peter." He did not kiss her, but took her hand and kissed her arm above the wrist in casual, intimate tenderness. He saw his mother standing there, and he said with a dashing gesture of triumph, "Mother, Dominique Keating." He saw his mother kissing her. Dominique returned the kiss gravely. Mrs. Keating was gulping.
"My dear, I'm so happy, so happy. God bless you. I had no idea. You were so beautiful."
He did not know what to do next, but Dominique took charge, simply, leaving them no time for wonder. She walked into the living room and she said, "Let's have lunch first, and then you'll show me the place, Peter. My things will be here in an hour or so." Mrs. Keating beamed.
"Lunch is all ready for three, Miss Frank—"
She stopped.
"Oh, dear, what am I to call you, honey? Mrs. Keating, or—"
"Dominique, of course," Dominique answered without smiling.
"Aren't we going to announce, to invite anyone, to—" Keating began. But Dominique said,
"Afterward, Peter. It will announce itself." Later, when her luggage arrived, he saw her walking into his bedroom without hesitation. She instructed the maid how to hang up her clothes. She asked him to help her rearrange the contents of the closets. Mrs. Keating looked puzzled.
"But aren't you children going to go away at all? It's all so sudden and romantic, but no honeymoon of any kind?"
"No," said Dominique. "I don't want to take Peter away from his work." He said, "This is temporary, of course, Dominique. We'll have to move to another apartment, a bigger one. I want you to choose it."
"I don't think that's necessary," said Dominique.
"We'll remain here."
"I'll move out,"
Mrs. Keating offered generously without thinking, prompted by an overwhelming fear of Dominique.
"I'll take a little place for myself."
"No," said Dominique. "I'd rather you wouldn't. I want to change nothing. I want to fit myself into Peter's life just as it is."
"That's sweet of you," Mrs. Keating smiled,
while Keating thought numbly that it was not sweet of her at all. Mrs. Keating knew that when she had recovered, she would hate her daughter-in-law. She could have accepted snubbing. She could not forgive Dominique's grave politeness. The telephone rang. Keating's chief designer at the office delivered his congratulations and said,
"We just heard it, Peter, and Guy's pretty stunned. I really think you ought to call him up or come over here or something."
Keating hurried to the office, glad to escape from his house for a while. He entered the office like a perfect figure of a radiant young lover. He laughed and shook hands in the drafting room, threw noisy congratulations, gay shouts of envy, and a few smutty references. Then he hastened to Francone's office. For an instant he felt oddly guilty when he entered and saw the smile on Francone's face, a smile like a blessing. He tugged affectionately at Francone's